You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
This panel is Demystifying the Cloud, What Adopters and Policymakers Need to Know. I feel really fortunate to be, as I told the panelists earlier, really fortunate to be moderating it because we have a really esteemed group here. Aside from their professional life, they're also really nice people, too. So we can take this. I'm supposed to also announce that after this, there's a reception downstairs, so we can take this sort of collegial panel and turn it into a party downstairs. I hope you'll all join us in doing that. So, but we're going to break with the tradition. I mean, they want these to be interactive, and I think this will be an interactive panel, but I think we wanted to start it by first going down, because there's sort of a pattern of build-up here from the kind of general areas to specific areas in the cloud. And Rodney Peterson's from EDUCAUSE is going to start us off.
So good afternoon. EDUCAUSE is an association of colleges and universities. We focus on the use of technology in higher education. So this topic is clearly one that's been near and dear to CIOs and campus IT leaders over the past few years. And I just want to kind of leave you with three points as we get started today. One is that, you know, when we look at this from a CIO perspective or from a college or university perspective, it starts with a business decision, which is really about how do we source IT. Secondly, there's a risk decision, which relates to how do we manage data. And then, of course, thirdly, there are some policy decisions which relate to how do we achieve our mission. So let me just take each of those real briefly, starting with the sourcing of IT. I recall 4 or 5 years ago when the cloud kind of became new and popular in higher education, I was first asked to speak to an audience of college and university business officers, and their request was to talk about outsourcing because they wanted to get IT out of the university, and of course their goal was to save money and to, you know, maybe decrease the number of IT staff that their institutions need. At the same time, the CIOs and IT community was saying, well, let's not start by talking about outsourcing. Let's start by talking about sourcing. You know, how do we source IT at the institutional level that's effective? And that may include outsourcing, but it may start with what do we do internally to be more effective. So, for example, at a large college or university, there may be several separate email systems or several separate systems that we could centralize and bring into a single data center where we could reduce costs and increase efficiency. So that kind of sourcing was one way of looking at it. At a large university, it wouldn't be uncommon that a central IT organization was running a very specialized service that only a local or a few faculty needed, and that may not make a lot of sense either, where that department or that college could take that back over or consider an outsourcing arrangement. So there are those kind of local sourcing questions. Secondly is how can we share services? And higher education loves to share. They love to share information. They love to share infrastructure. They don't like to share faculty or athletes in some other areas where we're competitive, but we do share a lot of things. And this is another sample where colleges and universities from Virginia to Michigan or other places that had very similar missions said, you know, why do we each need to run the same system or service? Couldn't we set up a shared infrastructure that allowed us to, again, increase our efficiencies and reduce our costs? The other way that happens naturally is for university systems. So almost every state has some type of university system, either for community colleges, four-year institutions, or research universities. And by sharing IT systems and services, it creates that efficiency. But then, of course, there is the question of do we want to get out of the business altogether and have somebody else do it? And again, outsourcing doesn't start with the cloud, right? It could be simply that you are outsourcing to somebody who's hosting those systems where the data and the systems are at a fixed location. But of course, cloud computing introduced this new paradigm where the systems and the data resided in multiple locations, perhaps throughout the world. So when we think about that business decision in an effort to increase efficiency, to improve effectiveness, and ultimately reduce costs, the first business decision is how to source IT. Secondly, which I think as we get into policy decisions today and discussions, you'll see where the data management becomes really critical. It becomes another risk management activity where you have to decide you assume or accept the risk by holding the data and running those systems on campus and make sure you have appropriate mitigation strategies to reduce your liability and minimize risks like security breaches. Or do you maybe transfer the risk to a third party, with insurance being a common way that you know, businesses do it and increasingly colleges and universities. And a third tricky area is as you outsource or begin to have the processes handled by others, can you actually assign or transfer the risk to those third parties? And as we'll probably have more discussion about later, that isn't as simple as it may sound with respect to protecting student education records that have federal compliance rules or HIPAA and health information compliance rules. Yet these very negotiations about how to assign risk between parties become a significant part of the contract negotiations when you talk about sourcing to a third party. And then finally, I just want to say, in terms of achieving mission, in higher education, we're not about administering IT systems or IT services as much as our audience would like to think that. We exist to provide teaching and learning to students, research and discovery to students and academics, and we have a service and outreach mission. So all of the things that we do around those three mission activities are really meant to enable and support those core missions. And IT is clearly a very significant enabler. It doesn't mean that we have to do it ourselves. It doesn't mean we have to invent it ourselves. It means we could very much partner with others who help us do the kind of sourcing that I talked about earlier. But let me just leave you with a couple thoughts related to mission. One is that you might think of business continuity as a key policy. We think of it as mission continuity or academic continuity. I spent last week with a few people who were sharing their experiences from Superstorm Sandy, and person after person said, the cloud made possible what we could not have done 10 years ago in the event of a disaster. We were able to keep courses up and running because our servers, our systems, weren't located locally where the disaster struck, but they were being hosted elsewhere or in the cloud so that our students and faculty could maintain contact and the academic mission could continue. That is a real success story and a testimony to the kind of mission-related continuity that we're seeking for. The second issue, though, is availability, because obviously whether it's the cloud or any kind of IT connectivity service, it's dependent on broadband. It's dependent on the resilience of the network, which includes information security, but it's also dependent on accessibility for persons with disabilities. And by way of example, EDUCAUSE is actively involved in a pilot working on electronic textbooks with some publishers and other providers that, you know, really provide a lot of good opportunities for students and faculty. But along the way, we stumbled across some of the challenges related to accessibility, that if it's not accessible to our students, then it doesn't allow us to reach our mission or obtain our academic continuity. And then the final issue, which I expect we'll have a lot more discussion about later, is that clearly privacy and security, much like many of your businesses, is a key concern for higher education. You know, on the one hand, I think the cloud offers greater protections and security than perhaps our smaller mid-sized institutions could provide by themselves because they don't have the expertise, they don't have the resources, they don't have the staff. The kinds of economies of scale that you experience with the cloud make it even more secure and more resilient. On the other hand, our campuses want to make sure that whatever standards, policies, practices we apply to make sure the information we hold is secure, that third parties do the same. And how do we know that? And we've started to develop some assessment tools to assess the security of third parties, leveraging what the Cloud Security Alliance does and NIST as well. And then, of course, that leads to whether or not we could have third parties audit that to make sure that as we trust others with our data, that we can be sure that they provide the same level of privacy and security and other policy protections that we would administer if we were holding the data at our institutions. So just a quick view from how higher education is sourcing IT and increasingly moving to the cloud and some of the pursuing policy issues.
Thanks. Devin?
Sure. So I'm Devin McGraw. I'm the director of the Health Privacy Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And I don't purchase IT or store health data myself, but I work on policies to enable trust in electronic medical record systems so we can bring the benefits of the digital revolution to healthcare where it's really so badly needed. The cloud actually offers some really terrific opportunities for health data when it's done right. So for those of you who don't sort of dabble in the healthcare field all that often, but you've probably all been a patient at some point. I mean, the data on health is collected in numerous places about you, your doctor's office, if you ever are in a hospital, when you go to the dentist, when you are insured by a health plan, There are just numerous folks involved in all of those transactions, and all of them are storing some piece of data about you that's related to your health. So it's very sensitive data in many cases, and it's data that consumers and patients actually really care about. However, many of the collectors and stores of this data are frankly rank amateurs with respect to data storage and utilization and access. I mean, we train doctors on how to take care of people. We don't train them on data storage and data security, data access, or data analytics, unless you're dealing with informaticists, and then they know that stuff pretty well. So other than your major healthcare institutions that have staff, CIOs, CIMOs, which are chief medical information officers, you know, you have a lot of solo doc practices or single docs or small groups where there isn't any technical knowledge existing within that space, and yet they are using electronic medical records. They're being, frankly, getting taxpayer dollars to use electronic medical records, and yet this is all very, very new to them. And so as a result, they're going to be heavily dependent on the technology vendors for their education about the solutions that do and do not work for them. In my view, cloud storage provides a lot of potential to take some of these issues on which doctors and some smaller hospitals, community health centers, have very little experience, to be able to outsource that to vendors who have much greater expertise is of great interest, not just in terms of good data security, but also in terms of being able to sustain access in disasters. We had Sandy, we have hurricanes, we have earthquakes, storage on site. If a disaster were to happen, that can sometimes compromise the ability to find patient records, and that having that access saves lives. But it's also the analytics side. I mean, we're part of the reason why Congress approved spending billions of taxpayer dollars to provide incentives for doctors and hospitals to buy electronic medical records was to improve the way the healthcare system works and have it work better at a lower cost. And that's going to require data analytics. And the kind of analytics, frankly, that a lot of healthcare providers don't have firsthand knowledge of, but many of whom are quite interested in sort of understanding a bit more about how well they're caring for their own patients, as well as contributing to the knowledge base about what works better in healthcare. So again, has a lot of potential. There is an increasing amount of uptake of cloud solutions in healthcare, but it's still maybe not what you would expect, and I think there are a couple of reasons for this. One is, again, this issue of the unsophisticated purchaser and the dependence on vendors for information about what systems ought to be purchased. And so as a result, there's a lot of myths out there about whether or not you can use a cloud-based solution if you're a healthcare provider, largely with respect to what is permitted under HIPAA, which is the set of federal privacy and security rules that apply to most healthcare providers, most insurance plans, most hospitals. And, you know, you hear anecdotal reports of physicians being told that they're not allowed to use the cloud. Or, consequently, on the other side, that they can completely turn over all their responsibilities for data to the cloud and the cloud will take care of it, and the truth is somewhere in between. But nevertheless, I think it presents the same sort of issues that Rodney just talked about, but just applied to health data and using quite often a set of unsophisticated players. So that's all I'll say for
great.
Now.
Great, thanks.
I'd like to go on. I'm Dan. Not going anywhere, so questions are...
All right, thank you. Thank you both. And it's important that we started with mission areas that are affected by cloud as opposed to technology, because at the end of the day, it's how cloud and can be made more efficient to help in different types of mission areas, both for the government and for society. I'm Dan Shenock. I'm the executive director of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And I also have been just completed a 6-year tenure as the chair of the Federal Information Security and Privacy Advisory Board, and our board advised NIST and OMB and the Congress on matters of security and privacy, and have looked at cloud issues and security and privacy for some time as well, and then was at OMB prior to that. And so I'm here to really talk a little bit about the title of the panel, I think, was Demystifying the Cloud. And so you've heard a little bit about the applications of cloud in key areas that affect us all, health and education. I'm sure that if we all raised our hand and tried to define the cloud, we'd all have a slightly different definition. So I'll try to just provide a simple view, which is any definition that incorporates distributed resources, so computers can be anywhere, you've heard that, and those distributed resources come together over largely over open internets, but sometimes in a closed way in a large enterprise, let's say, to, in real time, make a computing transaction more effective. So it could be that it makes computers work faster, it could be that it gets to information faster, but it's all about connecting computers that are located in different places and servers located in different places and creating more efficiency and effectiveness at a reduced cost for a consumer or a business person or a government person. This has a lot of benefits, and you've heard about some already. In addition, you know, cost savings is key to an organization for the cloud. You really, if cloud is done right, you're only paying for what you're using. You're scaling up transactions so that the computing resources aren't really humming at 100% all the time. They may be, you know, through virtualization, they may be only at 20% if that's all the computing power you need. And then if they're really doing their job well as a cloud provider, they're actually taking that 80% and giving it to somebody else so that they're really maximizing their value as a provider and serving more customers themselves as an IT entity. Cloud is very green. You don't need to build as many servers or as many server farms, creating as many environmental impacts. And cloud really promotes innovation. I'm sure in other sessions at the State of the Net, you've heard a lot about innovation. Through the cloud, you bring together networks of coders or innovators in really new and exciting ways through, you might have heard the term platform as a service, who come together and develop applications and really can share information in real time in ways that they never could before. So the cloud enables a lot of these kinds of benefits. Now, there are issues with the cloud, and I'll talk briefly about three of them, and then we can get into more of a discussion. Those really relate to how well is cloud implemented, security and privacy, as we've heard about, and international issues, cross-border issues in terms of how data flows and what policy regimes are involved. Implementation is really about getting your IT house in order. And in that sense, cloud is another manifestation of good IT management. And if you do it well, whether it's cloud or mainframes or client servers, it can have great benefits. And if you do it poorly, any of those types of technologies can be done poorly as well. So really establishing a governance framework is very important for commercial enterprises as well as for government. And I know you're seeing some attention from the Congress on how government is addressing this challenge now, and some discussion among agencies. The second issue involves security, and we've heard a little bit about the cloud itself isn't inherently more or less secure, at least in my view and in the view of our research that our center has done, than other forms of computing. You can implement a mainframe really well or really badly and create lots of holes, and you can implement a cloud scenario really well with lots of continuous monitoring points and real-time response and patching that's done in real-time, et cetera, or you can do it poorly. It's really a matter of the cloud has properties that can lend great security to any transaction, health, education, consumer transaction, government transaction. Some of those properties, just very quickly, are you can basically set up surveillance points across a cloud environment that can show you in real time when there's a vulnerability and not wait for it to have to travel through cyberspace and hit a particular piece of technology, and then that report gets sent back to a systems administrator who then takes the time to send reports back out to all the users of the system who then have to go ahead and patch the system and download the patch. Through the cloud, you can actually do this all in real time. As soon as you see the vulnerability, you can issue the patch, and it gets done quickly and easily if it's done properly. Devin talked about analytics. You can actually use predictive analytics to say, where's the traffic coming into to a cloud network? How can I predict, knowing that where the patterns of vulnerabilities were before, how to get better at spotting those vulnerabilities and threats in the future, and how can I basically move to put up a wall before the threat even hits that part of the cloud environment? So you can use analytics to basically detect the traffic, what's happening to it, different types of, you know, there might be some malware coming in. You can track it over time and identify patterns and then develop response strategies in advance. And finally, if you think about mobility, all of us, I'm sure, probably have mobile devices in this room. Through the cloud, you don't have to store a lot of stuff on your device. So if you leave your iWhatever machine in the cab, it probably won't have nearly as much on it if somebody picks it up, because most of the stuff you're doing, you're actually connecting to a cloud server, and the actual device is more like a just a delivery mechanism rather than a storer of a lot of information. So it can be very secure in different ways. Finally, around the global innovation model, many people have talked about different regimes in terms of you know, which government has more or less surveillance. And there was a study done last year by Hogan and Lovells that looked at about a dozen different countries. And actually, the U.S. was pretty responsible. Most countries have different laws and regimes that allow them to basically go in and inspect. And you heard some of this if you were here for the last panel. Around sort of the government's ability to monitor and inspect computing information. Many countries have these types of regimes. The key is that, in our view, for the government to really work with other governments in terms of cloud efficiency, to harmonize these regimes and to work with companies that are multinational and also located in those countries to promote it so that when cloud information does travel across borders, which it inevitably will, companies and governments don't have to think about, well, which country am I in, and which set of laws do I have to put up to follow, and so what do I have to put into the code to make sure that my transactions follow those laws. The more harmonization there is in terms of cross-border passage, in terms of privacy, the more effective and efficient the cloud will be, and conversely, the less there is, the more it will cost to develop a cross-border cloud environment. So this type of international harmonization, also around open standards, is something that and interoperability of software applied to the cloud is something that that many companies in this space are looking at. So that's a view, and happy to turn it over to Robert.
Great. Thank you, Dan. Thanks, everybody, for being part of this conversation. Why does the discussion around the cloud, both from very specific uses in areas like healthcare and education, why does that have the kind of resonance that it does, and why are the type of investments that companies are making occurring? And they're really occurring because of the transformational nature of the cloud. And it is sort of the issues around scale. I mean, the scale both in small use settings, you know, this building, this city, this Congress, this group of states, this nation, the scale provides us ability through these shared resources and pool resources to do more with less at a time, particularly when governments are being asked to do more with fewer dollars. This is a huge opportunity for governments and throughout society to get this right. The second thing is really about the sort of shared responsibility that comes with all of this. I mean, there are a set of tools that are being provided both from infrastructure and applications that can allow organizations to focus on the mission-critical business. But there's also a shared responsibility where both the providers of the technology, the conduits of the technologies, and the users, both institutional and at some level individual, have shared responsibilities at every step in the process to make sure that the integrity of the data and the privacy is maintained. But what's the transformation in all of this is, and I'll take healthcare for an example, is the ability not only that healthcare entities and governments can reduce or limit their healthcare costs, but that those institutions can focus on what they do best and they have the greatest value, which is delivering healthcare. And so as much as possible, if we get organizations to focus on their core business using the kind of shared tools that come through the cloud, then it's a huge win-win. And that's why I think the U.S., particularly as the largest single user of IT in the world, is well-positioned to capitalize on this at this point in time where the government is asking a whole bunch of tough questions with taxpayers and citizens about how do we do more with less. So there couldn't be a better time for the type of transformational technology than what we see now. But the questions really posed are the ones that we've seen on this panel, and let me just address sort of two of those briefly. I'll talk about the issue around, you know, security and privacy. And there I think really the key issues are around what the nature of that shared responsibility is, the level of transparency that comes about on the part of cloud providers about what they are doing to ensure the integrity of the data. And it also comes about on the level of transparency around the users of the cloud. So, for example, in an educational situation, you know, the user is both the institution, the user also moves on down to parents and students. Those collectively are the users. And then there are questions around transparency of what happens to that data. Not only is the sensitive data about a student's performance or health or attendance or other records important, and we believe that that's a, you know, it's an absolute, but there also needs to be transparency around how that data might be used for other purposes. Absolutely, there is huge value around the analytics because, of course, what those institutions should be doing is to try to improve the quality of education. But there needs to be transparency when the cloud is used or the services on the cloud around, is that data somehow being aggregated from those students and used for advertising purposes, used for identity purposes? And again, every institution and group of parents and educators can make those decisions, but there needs to be real transparency around that, and that conversation needs to occur. So absolutely there are these scale and other benefits around it. And then I want to emphasize the point that Dan brought us back to, which is really the global and international nature of this. As I started, what matters in this is scale. And the scale around this matters even more when it's a scale not just in this community or in these United States, but more broadly. And we need to make assessments around where you can scale cost effectively. We can make assessments around the level of sensitivity of data that's held in the cloud. Some might be so sensitive that it has to be resident within a clear geography. Other data is not particularly sensitive, and it could be stored anywhere at any time. And we need to have both the ability, particularly when you move into a business sector and you move into the economics, that the cloud can operate globally. And then in the U.S., we have a particularly important role to play in making sure we get it right domestically. And that is not only for what it means for our citizens in these core areas, but every country will look to the U.S. in part as a model for either what can be done right or what's done wrong in the area around the cloud. And we need to be setting a standard that both looks at the opportunity, looks at the right legal framework, but we need to know that for the U.S. as the largest single innovator and U.S.-based companies as the largest innovators around the cloud, that we also need to allow the proper market forces to coexist with the government policies and regulations so that we can experience and obtain the kind of innovation that we need globally. I will make one plug for this because this is this is my Bible at this point. There's a BSA Cloud Computing Scorecard that's available on our website for BSA, the Software Alliance, and this looks at 24 countries that are 80% of the global ICT market, and it looks at the whole mix of policies ranging from privacy and security to intellectual property protection to openness of trade. And there is both an analysis that is purely objective of what countries have what laws in place and how those interact, and then some tests that we've applied to it where we're transparent around the things that we think that matter. And so, you know, the U.S. ranks highly in this survey. The U.S. doesn't rank as the single best country for policies, but at the end of the day, these all matter together. It's about scale and it's about opportunity. Thank you.
It was great. Thanks. So just following up on that that point, I was wondering if the rest of the panel could talk a little bit about what they're hearing from policymakers, and Robert, you can fill in from what you see in the scorecard too, about kind of the top two or three issues. Dan mentioned, surveillance policy, but policymakers around the world, particularly outside of the United States, internationally, what are they telling you are the main issues? And then inside the United States as well, what are the main issues that you hear? And is there a difference between the two? And
so,
you guys.
I would say the issues that we talked about earlier around interoperability of policy regime is key, both for governments and for companies that are working with those governments. And then protection of data as across every, there's lots of, within that interoperability discussion, there's the EU data regime and directive, and there's the U.S. Law, and Devin touched on healthcare, and there's education laws and government laws and children's laws and lots of other laws that are different in terms of how they protect information. And so I think it's both, creating computing interoperability, so creating standards so that the actual hardware and software can work more effectively, and then policy harmonization, I won't use the word interoperability, or policy consistency may be a better term because harmonization implies one. It's really consistency and an interoperability, if you will, so that as you're working across borders, governments can work together more effectively and companies can work together more effectively as well.
Anyone else want to?
I would say for colleges and universities, it really comes down to complexity and uncertainty. Because as I said earlier, we've got a range of institutions, 4,000 plus, from small colleges who probably don't have inside legal counsel, they don't have a lot of IT expertise, to large, sophisticated research universities who probably have the in-house expertise. So just to give you a couple quick examples, with respect to student education records, which is governed by the federal law FERPA, or the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, I would say a fairly common practice has been for schools who want to outsource their email to feel comfortable doing that for students but not for staff. And it's primarily because of the uncertainty as well as the concern that the staff and faculty communications might actually include FERPA-protected data that they suddenly lose control over, whereas student communications, student-to-student, doesn't fall into that compliance framework. So that complexity and uncertainty has kind of resulted in some risk decisions that a lot of institutions are adopting. The second example is, particularly as it relates to the cloud, is that institutions are not comfortable with servers and data that's going to reside outside of the U.S. because the application of international law, concerns about export controls, or a lot of issues that put it kind of on the high risk level that is limiting in their contracts and willingness to contract with cloud providers who can't commit to keeping the data within the states.
Healthcare also has an issue of uncertainty and this issue of control. I think it's a very scary proposition for a lot of healthcare providers to think about having their data management functions not within their four walls. They're responsible for that data. They know that. And the idea that they would cede that, some portion of that, to somebody else and yet still be liable, in fact, for those decisions is very scary. There was a recent enforcement action by federal regulators under HIPAA against a very small, relatively speaking, physician practice in Arizona, and the issues were about their cloud provider essentially falling down on the job with respect to meeting HIPAA obligations on privacy and security. And so that's not condemnation of the cloud generally, but it gets to the point that has been made on this panel that the cloud's not magical, right? Mm-hmm. It's not. Just because it's a cloud solution doesn't necessarily mean, therefore, it's perfect and it's good and you don't have to worry about it anymore. You still have to do your diligence, pick the right provider, and be mindful that you're still, sort of responsible for managing that relationship, even though you're not no longer responsible for the day-to-day aspects of doing things that would be better done by somebody with more expertise. So it's been a big issue and I think a big barrier to the acceptability of these solutions, particularly and that's really for both small and large practices, mm-hmm. right? Because then if you have the IT staff, you're probably more likely to think that you're better off having a server on site.
Let me just say, from an immediate policy perspective, I think the thing that's most important for the U.S. to drive in the area of global cloud policy is what we're trying to do through the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the TPP. I mean, the type of cloud discussions that are occurring in that context are the first of the cloud computing era. The U.S. has the most at stake in any country in getting this right, and I think that's the earliest and most immediate opportunity for the U.S. to get the policies right with our key trading partners. I think there are really kind of three things driving this. One, I think, is the discussion internationally that's happening around privacy. And candidly, I think a lot of that's being driven by the discussions around the EU privacy regulation and the quite explicit goal for the EU to be setting the global standard for privacy and using that process as a way to do it. I think the second thing is around the issue of location of data. And certainly I respect and hear and understand, you know, Rodney's point about why educational institutions and others want to make sure that they know where their data is being stored. But I also think we have to move away from a knee-jerk reaction, whether it's in education or government, that says all data has to be stored in our country. There's a whole lot of data that if it's stored in a cloud setting in a secure way, it doesn't matter where it's being held. And it's easy to see that if we insist, I would think erroneously, that all U.S. data has to be stored in the U.S., every other country is going to do exactly the same thing. You chop up the cloud into little pieces and you lose the scalability. And then finally, what is less said, less explicitly, but I think is quite implicit in a lot of what we're seeing internationally, is other governments saying that they want to change the equation around IT in a cloud environment so it breaks up the ability of the U.S.-based IT industry to continue to drive the next wave of cloud computing. So I think a lot of discussions around requiring data to be housed, requiring the location of servers in various countries are all ways that governments are trying to say, let's reduce the American influence in this environment and have a more distributed environment. Again, things that break up the scale, they break up the promise of the cloud, and I think things where the U.S. role is both important domestically but as the international precedent.
Just one point, taking off on the thinking of something that the U.S. government is doing. Some of you probably have heard of the FedRAMP program. And there the U.S. government is trying to address a little bit of the issue that Devin raised around being able to trust that whoever's providing is meeting clear standards to protect data, whether you're a healthcare provider in the government or the Department of Commerce or the Office of Management and Budget, my former agency. It's basically being very clear and using, you know, provisions of contract law, which are very familiar to governments in the business community for well over 100 years, and applying those provisions to be clear about the standards that companies need to follow when they're providing those services. And if that's clear and the mission providers or companies that are working across borders are being clear to the companies about what standards they need to meet, and those standards are essentially interoperable in the FedRAMP case across agencies, or as Robert's saying, looking to interoperability across governments that transcend borders, then IT companies are really good at providing a very efficient solution because they're going to make money doing it. And so creating that policy framework and then asking those that are contracting with companies to be clear about what standards they want those companies to meet can provide for accountability and a level of service that hopefully will instill confidence over time.
So at this point, why don't we open it up to questions? I have a few others if I'm jumping to the gun here. Okay, let me move on to this. Go ahead.
Mr. Peterson and others, academic groups certainly understand and want to cooperate. I've been looking recently, for example, at a very competitive world with the group that's developing the Ultraviolet Cloud Service, which is an entertainment service that has been in process for several years because the movie studios and other companies aren't so comfortable with letting anybody get into their content through any direction. Is there a middle ground? Are these extremes? Are there further extremes in how trusting competitive organizations are of the ability of the cloud to really deliver a terrific service to a lot of potential users. And again, this is a consumer service, so it goes beyond the kind of clientele of BSA or the other medical areas that you discussed.
I mean, I certainly think it's quite possible in healthcare, but because healthcare providers have anti-competitive concerns too with respect to their data, right? It's oftentimes a condition of sharing data with anyone is real clear knowledge about who can use that data and access it and for what purpose, and not just the patient identifiable data, but even data that has identifiers of patients stripped or masked or is in the aggregate, but has a lot of identifiability with respect to the provider, right? How well am I taking care of patients? How well are my doctors following evidence-based guidelines and providing care? How well am I controlling costs for my patients with diabetes? You know, that kind of data in the hands of someone who makes decisions about how much an institution gets paid or what their rank is incredibly important from the healthcare provider side. So, you know, it certainly can be a cloud solution that makes a commitment to a provider that says, here's what we will do with your data, and here's what we won't. And if I were a provider that had those concerns, I wouldn't move forward with any provider that didn't give me absolute transparency to resolve any concerns I have with my data. I think that's sort of, again, part of the mystery. People without sort of knowledge that again, cloud's not magical and it's not one size fits all. It's an option, it's a tool, and it can be structured in a myriad of different ways to serve a myriad of different needs. And the devil is always in the details in terms of sort of what you're buying and what you're offering and what you're signing up for.
Even though I remarked about the culture of sharing within higher education, I remember a few years ago when we were exploring this third-party risk assessment approach, the financial services industry were already doing this with something called shared assessments. And in conversations with them, you know, they said, obviously we're competitive from financial company to financial company, but when it comes down to operations and IT and other things, we work together remarkably well across organizations because we have common interests. And I think one area that I didn't comment on, and I know that they raised with me as well, is this issue of bringing together the common demand, not only in terms of, you know, services and products and deliverables, but cost. You know, we've talked a lot about cost, and, you know, it's not a given that just because we have this new IT paradigm that the costs are going to go down, but if you can bring together communities with similar demands, similar needs, and similar interests to kind of drive down costs, do demand aggregation, it really leverages that culture of sharing that otherwise, you know, it's individual institutions contracting one-on-one with providers in ways that aren't going to really drive down the cost or the kinds of concessions you might otherwise get.
As a follow-up, though, you specifically mentioned other issues that sometimes are part of the decision, the three decision processes. And in this case that I use, copyright, of course, is a big issue in there. Shared revenue between a number of parties in the transaction. And again, are there any models for any of that yet, or assume that these will be worked out?
Models for
to assure the security and the revenue shared in whatever contractual relationships that two or three parties in the value chain may have.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one that I've alluded to, but be a little more explicit about, within higher education, when the cloud became new, and again, we were hearing from business officers who said outsource it, we were hearing from CIOs, they said, we really want to aggregate the demand. There's really no organized way in higher education where we come together to do this. And so Internet2, which is kind of a partner association of ours, created something called NetPlus Services. And their NetPlus Services is an attempt to look at all the IT providers, particularly the cloud providers and others, and say rather than 4,000 institutions having to work individually with them, which quite often would mean a form contract where there is really no true negotiation, we're going to aggregate that demand. We are going to take on the task of having a single legal agreement. And to some extent, they're becoming an intermediary where they're negotiating the price, they're negotiating the terms and conditions, so they're standing in the middle in a way that leverages, which quite frankly the business is like as well, because rather than having to contract and negotiate with dozens, if not hundreds of institutions, they now have a single point of contact that they can go to and get the return on more marketing and more customers as well. So it's called NetPlus Services run by
Internet. Can I follow up on that? Yeah. Maybe Dan and Robert can respond to this. So it's interesting that you raise this, and Dan raised FedRAMP too, which is not very similar, completely yeah. dissimilar from that. You also have, Rodney, also you talked about how small institutions benefit from using the cloud, and Devin gave the example of a small institution that was felt punished for using the cloud, right, in some ways. Although, you know, I tend to look at it more from the side that Rodney was saying, which is we know there are lots of institutions that don't have, small institutions that don't have great internet security today, and in fact, so many that couldn't be much worse moving to the cloud. But in terms of how we go about looking at that from the broader aspect, is something like FedRAMP or NetPlus scalable to the point, is it worth doing, or is the market forces alone where you have, because you have the reputation at stake of some of these cloud providers, or will it just wreck everything? If you leave it up to the market, will end up one small mistake end up wrecking the entire marketplace for everyone. So there's sort of lots of different possibilities out there. How are you two in particular looking at these issues moving forward, and what the policy should look like?
Well, look, I think the FedRAMP approach has been a very effective one in large part because as the government was looking of how you expedite the process, there was really a lot of involvement of the private sector in providing comments and input. And I think really the key in this is that you have to ensure that you get that involvement for both the people providing the infrastructure, people providing the services, as well as the customers, in that case the government users. I'll just say in response to the question that was posed a second ago, I think one of the best opportunities as well, which is hugely important for government around using the cloud, are some of the things that happen around the sort of built infrastructure. Governments, and I think, you know, some of the barriers exist. I mean, the question was, you know, where would competitors work together? Well, the point is, you know, where our competitors have a common interest. And, you know, one of those is reducing costs where they do. So if you look at the federal government, you know, the federal government's the single largest owner of infrastructure for the built environment, from both buildings to roads in the world. And so through the cloud, you can reduce some of the costs of that through analytics and other information. It doesn't really raise the sensitivity levels that some things like patient data may do. Large, you know, building owners, landlords have that same interest, and there people are willing to share it across borders. And I think it's a great example where the U.S. hasn't been leading in this way, in the way that some other countries, particularly the U.K., has been leading. So I just, you know, I look at, you know, FedRAMP is a great model because of the involvement of the private sector, but I think we need to take that and apply it to multiple areas where the government has an interest in doing more with less. And in some of those areas, the use of analytics will be super important to make the government do more with less.
So I think a term along those lines that you're hearing a lot in government circles is shared services. And there's a shared services strategy that the administration's put out recently. And basically, if you think of computers as becoming kind of like pencils, right? They're commodities. And once a technology of any kind becomes commoditized, the cost differential between providers is very minimal. So it's not like companies can make or break each other, because the commodity pricing that people are willing to pay is basically the same. So by using a shared service approach and scaling in a cloud environment, companies can then compete and provide value in areas that are basically higher value add in terms of services that they provide, and not so much these basic pieces of infrastructure that I think, to Art, back to your question, is scalable. I think the government's learning a lot from what global integrated enterprises have done in terms of going the shared services model to reduce cost and basically take those commodity costs to a minimal level, and then really look at what's the value that the company can provide, or what's the value that the government agency is trying to achieve, and then using the cloud as almost a delivery mechanism to say, all right, we're gonna pay, those commodities are gonna rest on the foundation that we'll provide as a technology shared service, and then we'll use the cloud as a delivery mechanism to deliver value in things like banking or transportation or education or healthcare, and provide and use the cloud to help enhance those mission services where you can get the differentiation among providers.
Are there any other questions out here? Or should I move to my next question on my list here? So, I mean, one thing that has come up, and pretty much it comes up at every cloud panel, and only Dan was the only one who raised it, and this one is definition of cloud. And, you know, there's...
I didn't put it to rest. With my
well,
it was a good question.
From my perspective.
In fact, I'm going to ask you to write that down and send it to me.
This is my question is, are we past that at this point to where there's basically, when you get a group of experts together, you don't spend enough time rehashing the definition of the cloud debate? And is that true internationally as well, or are we still at a point where we have to go back to the beginning and some it's a lot of conversations?
Well, you know, part of the reason I started with the sourcing IT kind of paradigm or continuum is because it is a continuum, and the cloud is kind of at the end of that continuum where there's a lot of other steps that could lead up to it. But quite seriously, the legal issues, the contractual issues, the policy issues are the same. If you're sharing services, if you're outsourcing, if you're doing all the things short of cloud, there are some perhaps unique aspects to the cloud. But I think recognizing that, you know, maybe cloud is the way people are going, but, you know, 90% of what they're doing in those other continuum areas where these policy issues apply today already, I think is part of what we're trying to get across. So I don't disagree that having a really good specific definition of the cloud is important, but it's along that continuum of way that we share services.
Yeah, I think it's better not to continue to have Talmudic arguments over definitions to get into, you know, what's the value and how do we make the cloud most efficient?
Yeah, I still think in the healthcare industry high degree of misinformation about what cloud is and what it isn't, and you know that creates obstacles, I think, to adoption of cloud models for health data. But conversations at the level of sophistication with an audience like this, they don't, you know, the definitional issues are, we're way past them. But in terms of sort of communicating to healthcare providers that, you know, what their that cloud is an option that they can explore and what they should be looking for if in a data storage and analytics and services solution is still sort of it's a missing piece of information out there that's pretty badly needed. And I can't point my finger at the government. I actually think they've on numerous occasions talked about, you know, what the possibilities are for using cloud for health data for the HIPAA covered environment, but it's just not breaking through. So there's still more work to be done.
And, you know, my experience is I think that cloud is well defined, and I think Dan's definition is as good as any, but cloud is not well understood by policymakers. Yeah. And so I think it's not a question of how do we define it. It's a question of how do we take the definition and impart that on more people who are policymakers. And I simply say that from a lot of experience of talking to a lot of people who, in the privacy of not thinking they're having to ask a question in a room, particularly, you know, elected appointees, say, tell me what it is again.
Yeah.
So I think it's just sort of, it's repetition and it's getting right and explaining it. But I think then we have to quickly move to, you know, why does it matter? And then what are the metrics? You know, why does it matter to a government or a policymaker? And, you know, what are the issues around efficiency and cost? And where does it make sense? Where does it not make sense? I mean, sort of get into that sort of the fundamental discussion about the value and where it has value. And I think first we probably all need to start taking Dan's definition, promulgating it widely, helping people understand, and then say, okay, now you got that, let's get into how you
make decisions. Point out that since it is a DOC agency, that NIST does have a very, very similar definition. and you can look at NIST definition.
IBM's my member, so I'm happy to
IBM follows the NIST definition, and we're very happy as a
The defined versus understood is interesting, because I want to come back to Dan's point about commoditization, because the other reality with the cloud is that you don't need a CIO or a central IT organization or a CFO to approve employees in the organization going to the cloud, right? Any faculty member or student with a computer through a click-through agreement could suddenly be using a cloud service. And that's a real challenge, quite frankly. Right. You know, they don't always distinguish, is it a cloud service, is it hosted, or is it whatever else? But as I was saying earlier, it raises some of the same privacy, security, and policy questions that we try to control and manage at the centralized level. And I think what we call the consumerization of IT is a trend that is very concerning, and storage was used as an example. And if it takes us too long to get the contracts, the agreements, the service in place at a centralized level, every student or faculty member knows how to go and get Dropbox or whatever the storage service of the day might be instantly. And so that's a phenomenon of the cloud and these services that I think is, you know, making the definition, you know, even less relevant, but the issue is all the more urgent.
Any final questions? Do we have time for one more question? Anyone in the audience? Anyone here have on the panel?
I'm intrigued by this discussion. I'm Bob
Barron
from CIA, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. So we put up and we actually built for the cloud-based identity service for DHS. But our security people have now had us privatize the cloud so that it's behind our tech and it's shared within the DHS environment, not data storage within a commercial provider's environment. But I think it gets to your point that what I'm finding in my job is that many people are using circumvention, not of the identity service per se, but of the services, so that if I want information that's somewhere else, I'll Google it, or I'll go out to an outside provider of service. If I want streaming that doesn't fit within the definition of cloud, then I will, you know, go outside of that and, you know, drop the government device and pick up the private device. So I think the question for the panel is, how does an institution that's looking at this, this distributed process, establish enough guidelines for its people and bring it down to use cases so that they understand this is a no-no? I'm sorry I didn't come in on the education piece, but faculty shouldn't use the cloud, and I'll talk about that later. But I have been insisting, because I'm doing work for my university in fundraising, I said, this is stupid. I can't use your cloud, but anyone help me. If I could only set up a Salesforce instance, I could absolutely get where I need to be and when I need to be there. So the question I asked the panel to close up, I hope there's a couple minutes, is how do you set up the rules, and what are the use cases? What process do you see that will allow the runners, the walkers, and the crawlers to sort of use the cloud in a different way or a different manner?
So I think, you know, you're right. Information wants to be free, and information technology wants to be free too. And people are going to find ways to get to the information that they want. And if you create, I think it comes back to IT governance that the CIO controls, but that has to involve the users at different levels. And if the CIO basically creates a very rigid governance structure that's not really interacting with users and understanding those use cases, it's going to lead to the result that you're describing. Whereas if there are, if there's well understood sort of different levels of users in the environment, you know, you have a government agency that you're dealing with. You also have citizens and non-American national, foreign nationals who are in the U.S. Interacting with your agency, understanding those different use cases, and then applying governance frameworks to adapt security, privacy, computing efficiency to the different scenarios will allow you to have a more flexible approach. And I think that your question really raises the importance of governance for as a CIO, and I used to work with a lot of the CIOs in the government, how do you implement that governance in a proper way given sort of the vast improvements in efficiency that the cloud offers?
I'm not a hospital CIO, but I think the way this plays out often in those settings is that they, and it usually comes from sort of a regime for data access that's so strict that people build in end runs around it. Mm-hmm. And in a hospital in particular, often the physicians who work there are not employed by the hospital, but they have to use that record system to pull up data on patients that they see there. So they're, you know, the notion that, well, I don't like this, so I'm just going to use my own.
Actually, there's this example that I heard about a hospital where A surgeon would have his nurse log him into every station around the hospital every hour.
Yeah.
To make sure that he wouldn't get logged out, so that he would be free to type anytime that he
Yeah,
has
it,
so.
Yeah.
So this is an example of a workaround that happens at a hospital.
All right, I just want to quickly say that, you know, we think of administrative, technical, and physical safeguards. They're all collectively important. There's no way to control end users, and they're going to find ways around them. You know, we still believe as educational institutions that awareness and understanding are still important techniques. This month, we're celebrating Data Privacy Month. It's something we try to get all our colleges and universities to do awareness programming about how to protect your privacy, how to protect your students' privacy, and others you work with. You probably know January 28th is Data Privacy Day. So that's just one way to try to get at things we can't control. If we can at least raise awareness, maybe influence behavior, then that gets us along the lines of addressing those safeguards.
Well, with that, I want to thank the panelists very much. Thanks for coming and putting together this panel. And remind people, reception downstairs, drinks, food, networking. Hope you can make it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.